moved on to something else. So that sort of cheered me up, that the journalists can last even after the publications or newspapers have closed.
The future is promising because the past has been as well. We've been speaking with Anya Shiffrin. She's editor of the new book, Global Muckraking, 100 Years of Investigative Journalism from Around the World. It's out now from the New Press. Anya, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. If you like Counterspin, then please check out Extra, FAIR's magazine. The September issue of Extra looks at how journalists' obsession with balance skewed their coverage of Israel's attack on Gaza, and why the work of a former science reporter for the New York Times is gaining praise from white supremacists. Plus the immigration crisis, conflicts of interest at Human Rights Watch, and more. That's all in the September issue of FAIR's magazine, Extra. You can go to FAIR.org to find out how to subscribe. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
The time is 6:01. This is KBOO Portland. Next up, you'll be listening to Bread and Roses, where I interview a local puppeteer.
Get to know your candidates for the 2014 KBOO Board of Directors.
On-air candidate forums will take place Monday through Friday, September 8th through the 12th, from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. on Morning Talk Radio.
Listen in to KBOO every weekday morning, September 8th through the 12th, for the Board of Directors candidate forums. And call in with your questions.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
Marching at the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing Bread and Roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses. This is Twilight. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. Women have had this forum on KBOO since 1978. That's 36 years. We always welcome new collective members. So if you would like to host, produce, or engineer with us, contact Ani Haynes, KBOO's volunteer manager, at volunteer@kboo.fm. You can also find Bread and Roses on the web at www.kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to past shows, share comments, or show ideas. And you can always like us on Facebook at KBOO Bread and Roses. Tonight on Bread and Roses, we play a conversation I had with Katie McClenahan. Katie is a local puppeteer and founder of Beady Little Eyes, a puppet-based event company. Their goal is to collect, curate, and share puppetry to adoring audiences in Portland and beyond. You can contact her through her website at beadylittleeyes.com. There will also be a link to it at the show notes at kboo.fm/breadandroses. This is Twilight. Welcome to Bread and Roses. Tonight I have a special guest in the studio, a puppeteer.
Hello.
Hello there. So if you could introduce yourself, that'd be great.
Yes, my name is Katie McClenahan, and I run Beady Little Eyes Puppet Slams, a company here in town. We do puppet-based events and puppet slams.
I love puppets. As listeners might know, I also do puppet radio theater, which is airs on KBOO. Obviously, you're into puppets, but how did you start in your career of puppetry?
Well, let's see. I went to school in New York. I went to NYU, and I started by... I wanted to get a degree in musical theater, actually.
Okay.
So, yeah. I'd spent a lot of time growing up going to an after-school program in Texas where I grew up that was theater and dance and singing, and I was into choir, huge choir nerd. So went to school for theater, thought I wanted to do musical theater on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
And ended up taking a puppetry course, actually, about halfway through when I was sort of disenchanted with the business of Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the assignments was to go and see a puppet piece somewhere in the city. And
that's
I went,
a great assignment.
Yeah, that was what we had to go do. For over the course of the semester, we had to see several pieces. But one specific piece really kind of blew me away. It was, it was called Hiroshima Maiden. And it was in Brooklyn. It was in a theater in Brooklyn. Anyway, not really important, but I saw this piece and it changed my whole world and understanding of what a puppet could be on stage and how moving it could be, actually.
Wow.
To see a piece of theater that was improved by the presence of puppets, not removed.
Okay.
And I sort of realized that there's not a whole lot of exposure in America and to Americans to see puppetry that it is moving and is a deep art form, like a piece of theater, like a a piece of art that you see in a museum that can be as moving as that. But puppets, it's not, it's an educational tool. That's what a lot of us know. Sesame Street, we know Jim Henson's Muppets, obviously. Mm-hmm. That he was a pioneer and his educational, he changed the world of education for a lot of people and in television too. But there's so much more. There's a lot more. And through live performances where I really get most excited about exploring puppetry. But that's sort of where I hit this point where I was thinking that, wanted to do theater, but then wanted to be involved in all aspects and found that puppetry, you're able to really use movement. And I never really was comfortable in a spotlight position as a performer. So you create your own world. You control everything in this world. It's whatever you want it to be. It's fantastical and it's amazing or it's silly or it's funny. A lot of my personal work is short form. So like the puppet slam stuff is all very short cabaret shows. But that's later in my story, truly. So I got into puppetry and somehow sort of fell into this puppet rock band in New York, which these kind of things.
Puppet rock band.
Yeah.
Go on.
These kind of things only happen in New York, I think. So just out of college, I was working in a retail store and ended up going to a show and connecting with this band called Jolly Ship the Whiz Bang.
That's a great name.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and they had been around for several years before I met them, and they had one puppeteer, and it was a band of eight guys, and it was a really incredible band, like pop rock band. They were really fun and entertaining and hardcore, and it was pirate themed, so it was pirate themed like rock operas are what we put on with puppets. So the formula was kind of like puppet show in like a if you can imagine like a chalkboard, like an old school chalkboard on wheels that flips around. That was they had modified one of those to look like a tiki hut, and then they had this big wooden ship, and we would do they were Balinese rod puppets, actually, were some of them.
Okay.
and then there was like a big clam puppet, and then there was fish. It was crazy. And the captain was one of the main characters, and I operated the captain and then sang backup vocals for them. And so I ended up just falling into this band at a time when they were really taking off, and they did a tour in Ireland, so I got to go with them to Ireland, which was great. And then we did a West Coast tour where actually the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art does the time-based art festival.
Okay.
And they brought us out from New York, and that's actually how I came to Portland for the first time and saw Portland and fell in love with it, actually. Then we continued to tour up and down the West Coast a little bit. There was an off-Broadway show that they did, and that was sort of that was as big as they got. And I think the whole band sort of disbanded after that. I had to step out when they did the off-Broadway show because I had another gig at the time in New York. So I couldn't devote full time to being a performer for that, but I think upon my years very fondly of on the high seas of Jolly Ship Blues Bang. And we just had such fun. Like, it was an incredible experience. And that spun me into a world of like, what is this puppet thing? Why do people keep handing me puppets to perform with? It wasn't really something I sought out. I was always crafty, and so people, in college, I was in shows where I was doing shadow puppets, and I didn't even know what I was doing, and I really wasn't interested in it. So then being in this band kind of introduced me to that world of puppeteers in New York. There's a place in Connecticut, there's an international puppetry conference. It's called the O'Neill Puppetry Conference.
Okay.
And that happens once a year in Connecticut. So I had always heard about it. And then when I moved here, actually, to Portland, I went back to the East Coast that very summer to try it out for the first time. And it's an incredible place. So that's what really hooked me in. I mean, I was always sort of dabbling and doing, helping other people do shows, helping craft stuff. But when I went to the O'Neill, the whole point of it is to create new work. So that's the thing. You go there with a seedling idea, and then by the end of the week, you're performing it for everybody.
Oh, wow.
With the help of other people, with other puppeteers, with other builders. Like, I'm not an incredible builder by any means. I'm like, if you give me a tool and tell me exactly what to do, I'm okay. But like, building is not my forte. So it's a lot of fun to go there and connect with people that love to do that. But, you know, then I end up being a singer in their show, or I'm a strong singer and a performer, and just, I like being on stage and I'm comfortable with it. So I'm able to offer that, and other people are able to offer me their building skills, and we all work together and make a whole and nerd out for a week. It's like, we jokingly call it puppet camp, which makes it sound sort of, juvenile or like, but it's really not. It's very serious. And it's like, I've met some of the most incredible people there. I've made connections. It's changed my life in every way, honestly. Wow. So usually when I do the puppet slams here in town, I'll do a raffle to try and benefit an alumni scholarship, or, you know, I'll donate funds to their alumni scholarship fund, which helps bring puppeteers back that have already been once.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, I can't speak more highly of that as an experience. And it's not just for pros. It's not for people that are professionals. And you can be a budding costumer, or, you know, you can be a painter that's just sort of interested in, you know, you want to make tiny costumes for puppets, or you want to paint, you know, scenery or whatever. And maybe it's for puppet shows. And you go there, and then you end up being able to dabble and join in all these different worlds. And, you know, there's work. It's like every minute of the day is packed. So it's like workshops and, you know, like master classes. And then you have like one track that's like your main focus. And you're most likely when you first go, you're like helping another artist put on their show. So you're being a puppeteer or just helping support that in some way. And then it's so social. So like all of your lunch hours, everybody's around each other. There's no cell phone reception. You don't have email. You like shut off and
That's
you're on
good,
this.
Though.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You're on this beautiful manor out on the coast of Waterford, Connecticut for a week. And so it's very, very focused, very intense. And that really, I mean, that spun me into exactly where I am, I think. It inspired so much and continues to do so. I try and go every year. I'm not always able to, but I just got back somewhat recently, so if I'm extra fired up about it, that's why. And then, so that was a sort of a long-winded way of telling you what my background is. It's sort of stepping stones to where to where I came to Portland. But when I came here with the band a long time ago, I moved back sight unseen 3 years later. I'd never come back to Portland. I just was here as a performer and then moved back because I really liked Portland and wanted to get out of New York City. And started, I hadn't been doing my own events or slams in New York because there's so many hurdles there, and there was already slams going on.
Yeah.
So when I came here, I realized that there was not a slam. And just because a lot of people don't know what puppet slams are.
I was just going to ask.
I'll tell you what a puppet slam is.
Yes, please.
So it's in a way, it's a short form puppet cabaret.
Okay.
So it's a whole bunch of different puppeteers using different types of puppets to tell stories. It's a storytelling event with puppets. And it's usually a little raucous. It's for the older crowds. It's not marketed for kids. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's raunchy or rated R in any way. Usually there's an F-bomb that's dropped here and there, and there's some swearing, and then there's some, you know, inevitably there's, I don't actually get to see every single show that gets to go on the stage. I usually get a pitch and I get some pictures I get a, and I get a general sense of what they're going to do. But I like to encourage, and not discourage the creation of new work. So a lot of times with everybody's time frame and scheduling, and I don't always have 6 months in notice of when the date's going to be, I like to be understanding of people needing to be able to create stuff and not worry about me curating it or telling them that they can't do or say something. But it's pretty open, and it can get kind of silly. But the shows range anywhere from 2 to 8 minutes in length. And they're always performed live, and it'll either be any form of puppetry, tabletop, marionettes, Jim Henson-style Muppety type shows, shadow puppets. I love shadow puppets. Yeah, there's several different forms. And the point of, or what I like to think people can take away from it, is if you walk into a puppet slam thinking you know what a puppet is, that you would walk out of it thinking something different.
That was true for me.
Yeah.
When I went to the puppet slam earlier this year, there were puppet types of puppetry I had never heard of before.
It's cool.
That was really nice.
Good.
Actually, that would be great. Just to kind of lead into my next question, if you could talk about the different types of puppetry.
Sure.
I think when I went to that puppet slam, I knew Jim Henson-style puppets, marionette. I think I had heard of shadow puppetry, but that was the first time I had seen it.
Cool. Yeah, I think after being so immersed in the world for so long, I try and force myself to remember that a lot of people have no idea. And so, like, I think naturally I like to show people rather than tell them, I guess. So that's sort of where the slams come from for me. But so there's, let's see, different forms of puppetry. As we said, marionettes, which, you know, are the dolls on strings, basically. And those, even within marionettes, there's a huge amount of variety in how you can build them out of wood and different types of joints. I've held and manipulated a lot of marionettes, and they are all very different depending on the builder.
So it could be simple, just arms generally moved, to complex, where you have the wrist, elbow, and shoulders, and even fingers.
Yeah. I mean, there can be tricks. Like, Philip Huber is a puppeteer I got to study with at the O'Neill, and he's responsible for the marionettes and Being John Malkovich.
Okay.
He puts a lot of tricks into his characters depending on what they're going to do. He has a Liza Minnelli marionette that starts out as an old woman and then tears off her wig and tears off her clothes and becomes young Liza throughout the course of a song. It's amazing. It's incredible. I mean, he puts in hundreds of hours into these masterpieces, truly. Marionettes, there's a huge, wide range of them, even within that one form. And then there's Bunraku, which is Japanese based, I believe, and it's usually the puppets are within like a foot tall, somewhere in there, and they're operated by several puppeteers, usually 2 to 3. Like, one's got the head and the neck or the body, and then one's got the two arms, another has two legs. So the puppeteers really have to work in tandem to make sure that it looks grounded and real and is breathing. And there's a lot of practice goes into that. And I want to know more about it. I'm not an expert on that type of puppetry by any means, but I'm hoping to when I'm going to Southeast Asia this fall. So I'm hoping to learn a little bit more. I'm not actually going to Japan, but just to see that in action a little more outside of what I've seen in the States would be really cool. And then there's shadows, as we said, and shadows are also very different. They can be on a overhead projector, like the old school that we had in school, but the kids these days probably have computers and stuff like that. But like an old school lighted projector that throws, you can manipulate. I've seen some really cool stuff where people throw sand on that because it's a tabletop essentially with a light on it. And then that projects up onto a wall using sand and water and oil. You can do lots of really cool stuff with that kind of projector. And then there's shadow projection, which is like you have a sheet and then you set a light up 10 feet behind it, and then you make shadows in front of the light that cast up onto the sheet, and then the audience is watching what's going on the sheet.
Oh, interesting.
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
So there's different kinds of shadow puppetry, too, within that genre. I'm sure I'm missing some, but...
What's the Henson type of puppetry called?
Everybody just kind of calls that, I think... Muppet style puppetry. Like, I don't think it has the aesthetics of his puppets is very specific.
Yeah,
so
very
it's
distinct.
Yeah, very distinct. And there's a lot of people that have emulated and, you know, borrowed from that aesthetic and make really amazing, funny things. But yeah, that's like the Muppety monstery mouth, you know,
yes,
mouth.
That's what I was
centric.
Okay.
Kind of stuff. And then tabletop is fun. I feel like was the last kind that I came upon. It's just like it sounds. You have a table, like a 6 foot normal size table, mm-hmm. and usually the puppeteers are wearing all black, and you do a show on top of it with dolls or puppets or whatever, and you kind of manipulate. Like I did the show Tucker John with my friend Liz Hara at the last Puppet Slam, and it's just everything's within like 5 to 10 inches big, and it can be tougher in a larger theater, that style.
I could see them.
But it's like the kind of puppet show you would put on for your friends when you were a kid. You just like move stuff across the table. It's like, it's really simple and fun and silly, and it all comes back to storytelling. I mean, it's all like all the types of puppetry, the main reason we're all doing it is to tell a story.
Right. Now, the tabletop where you dressed all in black, I think mm-hmm. at the Puppet Slam, there were a couple performers that had almost like beekeeping helmets mm-hmm. on with fabric over their face mm-hmm. to really camouflage them even more.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, that's like that's a funny personal preference I found when I talk to people, like, is it a fad? Like, is it cool to wear hoods or not wear hoods? Is it part of their show? Is it not part of their show? People have different opinions on that, and it depends too on the show. Obviously, as a puppeteer, you don't really want the audience to be looking at your face,
right?
But there's a school of thought where people think that if you don't, you shouldn't need a hood, because if you're a good performer, then the audience should be only looking at the puppets. You should be endowing them with all of your energy, and your face should be like stone cold. But I have a problem because I wear all my emotions on my face. So I usually end up cracking myself up. So when I do, you know, when people prefer that we don't wear hoods, I always warn them, like, okay, well, I'm probably going to get a little, like, I giggle and I break character. And it's sort of just my thing. It's part of the reason why I would have never been a Broadway actress, is like, I sort of wear it all right there on my sleeve. But yeah, and gloves are the same way. Some,
oh, really?
Yeah, some performers prefer gloves and some don't. I prefer it, especially with tabletop, actually, because you really, your hands can get super distracting if they're not part of the world, because you're, you know, just your, the skin tones in a world, like, it just, it's really, I think it can really distract. I've seen a lot of shows where it's pretty distracting to see people's hands. I think gloves really can help.
Is it another personal preference of the puppeteer whether, like, I don't know if you call them, the sticks are showing? Because I remember the Puppet Slam, some were super thin.
Oh, yeah.
Like dowels, but then some were kind of thick and
sure.
You just noticed them.
Sure. Yeah, the rod, they call them rods usually. I think it's, again, a preference, yeah. I don't think there's ever been... It's just part of it. Like, okay. I don't think anybody would ever be like, oh, my, you know, you can see the rods. You're probably always going to see the rods. I mean,
yeah.
It's part of the art form. It's part of the sort of rough and tumble way that things are put together sometimes. And, you know, especially too with like Balinese or Indonesian style puppets, like the rods are always going to be there. They're always going to be noticeable, especially in scale. If it's only like a 12 inch high puppet,
right.
you're going to see it. But usually they'll wrap them in black or paint them. You want to paint them black, kind of camouflage them a little bit. You don't want them to be metallic or sparkly or anything. Unless that's part of your show, which, you know.
True, it could be.
You never know.
At what point does it stop becoming puppetry, like, and start becoming a costume? When I saw Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, there was a man that was playing a lion, so obviously that was a costume. But he could have, you know, he had the big mane, like, if it was a mask, which it wasn't, that could have kind of been considered puppetry. So where's the line? Or is it a furry line.
It's a very furry line. I think that when it comes to full body costumes, they can, I mean, like, for example, Julie Taymor's The Lion King, if you've seen any of those pieces that she created for that Broadway show. Definitely, that's a blurry line in that show. Are those gazelle, you know, they're on dancer bodies. They're using right. the bodies of the performers in addition to the puppets or costumes. But I don't lose sleep over thinking about what's what. I do kind of sense, though, that, like, for example, someone in a clown costume is not a puppet.
Right.
But perhaps somebody, we used to have a host here for the slams, and every time I do them now, they ask where he is. But Mr. Toad was a full-bodied 6-foot toad that my friend Nicholas Mahan made. And that, I would say, is way more of a puppet. He used his hand on the inside of the costume to operate the mouth.
Oh, okay.
And then his actual head was in the top hat of the toad. So it really did look like a squatty toad wearing striped pants.
Oh, neat.
And that I would consider way more of a puppet than I would a costume.
Right.
Maybe it's because of the mechanics of him moving the mouth on the inside. You know, it's, yeah. you know, same thing goes for Big Bird.
I'd say Big Bird.
Big Bird is definitely, yeah. I mean, that they call those walkabouts sometimes in the puppet world, like the larger walkabout costumes. Like they are puppets. You're just using a lot more of your body to fill it out or manipulate right. it.
So with shadow puppetry, if it's on a projector, that's still puppetry, but then does it cease to become puppetry as soon as it's computer? Because, like, does that become animation?
No, I think it would only be animation if you were, like, animation if you're doing, like, frame by frame of the action.
Okay.
Or stop motion, rather. That's the same kind of idea. It's digitized. So if you were to take, like, if you were to set up a camera on a white screen and film a shadow puppet show that was live action, that would still be puppetry. It would just be on, you know, the medium would be for film.
Okay.
A lot of people think that to make a puppet film, it's the same, like you just record a puppet show, but it's actually a different medium altogether. Like you wouldn't do a live stage performance with actors
right.
is different than a movie right. with actors. It's just,
okay.
it's you have to curate it, or what's the word, retrofit it, I guess. You have to retrofit it to
okay.
the medium.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
you started doing puppet slams, and then when did you start Beady Little Eyes?
I started it in 2010, actually. I just moved here in March of 2010, and I made Beady Little Eyes a company in April, and then had my first slam in May. I was I'm very much a busybody, so I was out of work and decided that that's what I wanted to do, and I immediately saw that there was an opening to do that there were plenty of puppeteers, plenty of people wanting to make work, and just didn't have an organized brain to put together the space and give people a place to perform. And while I do consider myself a puppeteer, I think my greater service in the world, as I'm sort of traveling through this thing we call life, is to give artists a space to make work. That's why I really think that, in like a really sort of crunchy granola woo-woo, like that's why I'm here on Earth. I really enjoy giving people a space to go to and perform in. And I think that the only way you get better as a performer is to perform in front of an audience.
Yeah, very true.
And when people aren't given that, or don't have the wherewithal to even know where to start to produce something like that, it's super easy for me. And I really enjoy, I mean, I really enjoy puppet shows. So it's slightly selfish too, because I just want people to perform shows, so I get to, you know, I get to show other people what I enjoy so much. And I just feel like a little kid sometimes when I'm watching this shows that people put together. And I'm a collaborator at heart, so I enjoy also helping other people understand, you know, how things can work, or giving them new ideas. I spent enough time in New York between interning at the Puppet Heap, which is a puppet, it's like it's a workshop in Hoboken, New Jersey, and they do a lot of work with the Muppets. They did a lot of refurb when I was there. Anyway, but just sort of witnessing all of that and sort of taking in knowledge, but not, again, I'm not a super strong builder, but just to know the different ways that people think about how to build something, to absorb that and to help people here who maybe haven't been exposed to anything like that, who are just interested and just love puppet shows. Like I love to give everybody a chance to perform, and to also help them sort of wrangle their thoughts around how they're going to make it, and how they, you know,
right.
how they start. Because starting is always the hardest part with any creative process that you don't have any familiarity with.
Right, figuring out what even the first step is.
Yeah, and I always say it should start, in my opinion, it should start with story. Like, you should have a story to tell. I'm a big proponent of writing out what your story is and having an idea before, because a lot of people want to get straight to the building, and some people do come about it that way. They'll start building something, and then that puppet will inform what they want to tell.
Interesting.
Everybody has a different process, but yeah. You know, sometimes you have a store-bought puppet, and it's something you like came into your brain while you looked at it, and we're like, oh, this is the story of a porcupine who comes across a grasshopper and their story together, but you would have never thought of that had you not seen the puppet. So there's different ways to go about it, for sure. But I'm always open to giving suggestions and helping people realize their dreams.
And depending on the story, could influence what type of puppetry to do.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of times, like if I'm brainstorming and somebody really thinks that it's going to be a tabletop show, mm-hmm. it's kind of fun to be like, what if it was a shadow show? And then it's like, oh, you know, and if you go into a place of like story driven, like what could shadow inform? Like what could you do with shadow that you couldn't do with tabletop? Or what could you do with marionettes that you couldn't do with Muppet style puppetry? Right. It can all be very flexible. You can do both. Like you can, in the middle of a tabletop piece, you can turn on an overhead projector and then finish out the piece with shadows, you know, like. I was in a show where basically, like, this was in New York, but it was called The Colonists, and it was about bees and bunnies and their interaction. There was no words at all. It was all music. And we did some really neat stuff on a tabletop, and these bunnies they were 3D tabletop puppets. Mm-hmm. They would jump into the hole, and then we'd turn on a light underneath the stage, and you would watch a shadow bunny crawl into his hole down a little pipe, you know, and then like there were little babies in there, I think, or you know, that story, like he would go, I think he was cooking something, so the 3D puppet would disappear, you'd see the rest happen in shadow, and then he'd come up and he'd reappear and he'd make a pie. He was making a pie for these bees and stuff like that, like to mix mediums is really inspiring.
I hadn't heard of that before. That's mm-hmm. interesting to, mm-hmm. to mix different type of puppetry in one story.
Yeah. There's no rules. Do whatever you want.
Oh, I like the idea of creating your own world. So then mm-hmm. if you create your own world, you create your own rules.
Yeah.
So you can do mixed media.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of people, when you're developing a show, a lot of people will ask you at the O'Neill when you're talking about your ideas, a good question to always ask yourself is why puppets?
Okay.
Why not humans on a stage?
Yeah.
What is it about this story that needs to be told with puppets? Is it that you can do fantastical things like tear their limbs off and float them around stage? Is it that you can like they can fall from 8 stories high and you can really feel the impact? Like you would never be able to show that with a human on stage.
Right.
Or, you know, death scenes or birth scenes or like what is it? Like what is it that informs that is driving you to tell this with puppets and not through a poem or with people or on film? And I think when you can answer that, you have a better understanding of what your show can do.
I like that, because why puppets sounds like such a simple question, but the answer could be so complex.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. When I saw your puppet slam, there was Melvin the Birdwatcher, which was your project.
Yes, Melvin the Birder.
Yes, I'd love to talk about that song, because that was a great little show.
Thank you. Thanks. That was a short little 5-minute puppet film that we made, and it took us 2 years. Believe
five
it or
minutes.
Not.
Wow, that's impressive.
But it was because, so the way that came about was my friend Spencer Lott, who I met in New York. We actually met at an audition for a puppet show or a stage show. Mm-hmm. We totally hit it off. Like we just knew that from a work perspective, it made a lot of sense. We just were very spitfire together. So we decided to put together a pitch to Heather Henson, who's Jim Henson's youngest daughter. Mm-hmm. She has a foundation where she runs the Puppet Slam Network.
Okay.
Where Beady Little Eyes gets a grant from her, or has gotten a grant from her the last 3 years. We continue to apply.
Okay.
So she's an incredible force. Her way of carrying on the legacy is to give to puppeteers who are doing work that she cares about. It's amazing.
Nice. Yeah.
It's incredible. So she does these series called the Handmade Puppet Dreams series.
Mm-hmm.
And we applied to, and then she'll commission, there's no quota or anything, but she'll commission maybe one, maybe two films a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we applied for this last year. We basically, Spencer and I, Spencer lives in New York and I lived in Portland. So we were collaborating cross country, wow, which was kind of interesting. But we would have these lengthy phone conversations where he would just throw, he's like an idea machine.
Okay.
So he would just throw out like this and this and this and this and this, and then stuff would, like throwing spaghetti against the wall and something would stick. And he threw out this title, Woodpecker Love Song. And I was like, what's that? What is that? What's a woodpecker love song? So then we started talking about story, and he's, again, an idea creator. So he just started, he would just start saying stuff and going crazy. And then we sort of curated this sort of very loose storyline of this guy named Melvin who lives in the woods and is obsessed with birding, mm-hmm, and obsessed with documenting every species of woodpecker known to man. So we pitched that with some sketches. I pulled my friend Nicholas, who is also Mr. Toad that, mm-hmm, I spoke about earlier. He lived in Portland at the time. I pulled him into the project as a character designer and fabricator.
Okay.
So he started doing sketches of what Melvin was, and we went through a bunch of rounds, and we put together our bios and a very basic synopsis, wrote a script, I think, a very early rough script, and submitted that to Heather and got awarded the grant last year. So she gave us a grant, and she also gave Toby Froud a grant. Toby was the baby from The Labyrinth.
Yes, and now so, he lives in Portland.
And now he lives here. So it was kind of amazing, actually. I think they gave away 3 grants in that year, but 2 of them were here in Portland. Mm-hmm. And he made an incredible film called Lessons Learned. But so we both got awarded these grants. We were both sort of making our film at the same time, mm-hmm, which was kind of fun. But he... Oh, let me go back. So we got the grant and we started production long distance. In the middle of production, Nicholas actually moved to New York. So Nicholas and Spencer were in New York together. and Nicholas did all the building, and it's a 2D paper puppet film. Like we sort of just found these incredible diorama style paper sculptures that really inspired all of us. And we wanted to do something that we could create a world that was entirely our world,
okay,
but lower budget because, mm-hmm, we didn't have a huge budget, and could be simple and fun. And we had a couple other puppet films that really inspired us, but it was all sort of based around this very like sweet, simple, fun world that was quirky and, mm-hmm, sort of Wes Anderson-y, I guess, in a way.
I could see that.
Mm-hmm. So, and very character-driven. So we really wanted everyone to understand where Melvin was coming from, you know, like, we wanted people to know that he had never had a girlfriend without saying that. You know what I mean? It's pretty obvious, I think, when you see it. but it's a sweet story, and it was a lot of fun to film. We ended up shooting it here in Portland. Our DP was a man named David Emmett, and he's an incredible still photographer here in town who also does motion work.
Okay.
And he, all the ways in which he lit everything really made it come to life. Nicholas made every scene, like every shot you see is basically its own piece of art, like moving kinetic 2D art. So he spent an incredible amount of time creating and making this world in a way that being across country, I couldn't really see his whole process, but he was very autonomous about it and just did it, and did it so well.
What are the materials made out of?
It's mostly paper, okay, and foam core. He drew everything in graphite, and then there's, mm-hmm, some very light color. The only thing that was really adjusted in post-production was the color. We bumped up some of the color a little bit.
Okay.
Because it blew out a little bit when we filmed, because it's white paper with graphite. So, but you can see the rods, you can see some of the strings, but there is a lot of hidden mechanisms. So the eyeballs move and the mustache moves, and you,
right,
don't see, there's no green screen. We're not hiding the rods or anything like that, but it's all from behind, basically. A puppeteer is manipulating with little notches that he had made in the paper.
Oh, so
and
that's
little,
how you got the mustache to move.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. It's layered paper, basically, that moves in, you know, it all moves with itself. But, yeah, he nailed it, and it was really incredible. And then Spencer came in, and the 3 of us plus David Emmett basically knocked it out, filmed the whole thing in David's studio in 2 days. And then the editing came later, and the editing took, because everybody was sort of, you know, it's a smaller project on people's tables. So,
yeah.
But the editing took about 6 months because we had to get original music made, which was incredible.
Right.
A guy named Brad Kemp in New York made an original score to it. I did some singing, which I wasn't expecting to do, but there's like this reveal moment where you hear a woman's singing voice. That's me. Stuff like that. We would just scramble to get it done. We got it done almost in time. You're supposed to have exactly a year, but the whole, you know, just the cross country thing was really, I wouldn't say it was, it wasn't horrible at all, but I don't know that I would want to do it again that way, because it makes it more difficult. Yes. The time changes, and, you know, 3 hours time difference doesn't seem to be that much, but it is.
Oh,
it's a lot. And I wish I could say that it's available online easily for people to watch, but it's actually, we're doing the festival circuit thing until I think until March of 2015, so it's it's not freely screened or online. It's not online for people to just see just yet, but it will be screened at Dragon Con in Atlanta, I think.
Oh wow.
In September, and we've applied for some festivals and we're trying to get it out there. It's going to be at BAM in New York in October, I believe. I wish I had the dates.
Well, after the festival circuit, do you see it being available online then?
Yes.
Okay.
That's sort of the idea. And it will be traveling around to in the Handmade Puppet Dreams Volume 6, mm-hmm. which the whole volume is not available readily for people, but that they try and keep it close because it makes it more special when you can't just go online and see them. But Melvin we're planning to release it on probably our Vimeo. We'll make it live once we feel like we've run the gamut, because festivals are funny. I'm learning about this. I didn't know much, but you know, submitting, they want it to be private, or they want it to be made within a certain time frame.
Okay.
So really the hottest time to submit your film is right after it's done. So we're doing that. Yeah, totally. And so we're doing that now and trying to sort of spread the word out there. And no idea who, you know, it's the funny thing about performance is that live performance is that you know who's in the audience, or you know ish.
Rough.
But with a film, it's like, I don't know who could see this, you know, like,
that's
I don't
true.
Know what hands it could get into and different, like, who it could inspire, what it could do. So that mystery of that is kind of exciting. Maybe it'll drum up some work for all of us in different fashions, you know. Yeah, who knows? But my role was mostly story writing, and then I did some puppeteering, and then I was the producer of just all the shoot and the events and timelines and stuff like that.
Do you think you'll do another 2D type of film?
I don't know yet. I would like to continue. I want to keep the film thing going, and I for myself. And so I kind of want to do it on a little bit of a lower stress level.
Okay.
I don't want it to be something where I'm always privy to a grant. Like, I kind of want to do the quick and dirty kind of silly little puppet films for just to keep that going until I get another opportunity to make something like Melvin. I would love for that aesthetic of Melvin to turn into something full length, which would require grants or, you know, further funding. But that would be a dream come true if we could get that project to keep its, you know, that's what a lot of people ask us, like, what's next? Like, what are you going to do next? Are you going to try and make this a full length? Are you going to try and do something else? Are you going to make another short? And the three of us are kind of like, we're so exhausted. okay, we're just taking a breather. But
I can see that.
Yeah. But I would like to do some lower pressure sort of projects coming up. Nicholas and I we're thinking about working together. And I know Spencer's super busy. That kid's like blowing up in New York. So we all had a great experience working together. Aside from the distance, the long distance, I can't see any reason why we all wouldn't jump back into a project together if there was funding and people were interested.
Nice.
Yeah.
So after Melvin the Birdwatcher, you started working with tiny puppets.
Mm-hmm.
What was the inspiration to go really small?
Well, I love tiny things. Again, very selfish reasons. No, I actually do. I have always been very fascinated with small things and thusly small puppet shows. There's a whole, speaking of types of puppets, like we were earlier, there's toy theater as well.
Okay.
There's a festival in New York that I saw once, and I was a part of it too with Jolly Ship, called the Great Small Works Festival, and it happens every 2 years at St. Anne's Warehouse. So that's something that's really cool. They do like a tiny parade with tiny floats, and they'll do tiny puppet shows.
What's the size of a tiny parade?
Well, you know what? I have to say, I don't think I was there for the parade. I heard about it and I saw pictures, and it would be like somebody's, it's like somebody's little red wagon, but they'd built it out to look like a puppet stage and little tiny puppets dancing in there kind of thing.
Oh,
so
wow.
It would only come up like a foot off the ground from what I could see in the pictures.
Okay.
So I didn't see that in person myself. But it's celebrating small work. So the puppet slams are awesome. We've been doing them at the Imago Theater, and that's seats maybe 150 or so.
Okay.
And I thought about, there's a woman that I met at the O'Neill. She's an Australian woman named Lana Schwartz. She did this, I don't know what you would call it. You basically, she has a big box that she straps to her shoulders, and you put your head underneath a curtain in the front, and she does a puppet show just for you.
Wow.
So it's like a one person at a time can witness what's going on in there,
so,
and it's kind of like a peep show.
One puppeteer, one audience member.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I thought so too. And I was like, what is that? Why did that stick in my brain? Because I haven't seen her in a couple of years now, I don't think. She's Australian, so she came over from Australia for the conference.
So that's quite an intimate setting.
Uh-huh.
Like, in a way, that would make me more nervous performing for one person in like a group of 150. Because 150, you could figure, well, there's going to be a good percentage that's going to like it at least. But one person.
What if you really offend them?
Like, what if you really bomb and they hate it? Like,
totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the difference between performing for your friends and family versus an audience. Sometimes your friends and family care so much more about what they think that it's like, oh.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. So that sort of inspired an idea of like, what if I do small puppets in a small theater space.
Yeah.
There's a performer named Laura Height, and she's based here in Portland. She's going to perform in the Tiny Puppet Theater Festival with her show called The Matchbook Shows. And it's literally matches and matchboxes.
Really?
Very tiny. And I saw her perform in a large theater with a projector.
Okay.
So a live feed projector. It was camera set up right in front of her on the table, and she was doing all this tiny stuff, and then you could watch it on the big screen. And I think that's great. I think it's awesome. And her illustrations are so funny, and like her performance attitude and tone is like really, really hilarious. She has a really good thing going. So I reached out to her about this festival, and she's, it's an experiment for her too to perform in the Good Gallery. So Good, which is up on Mississippi, just one block north of Skidmore, right across from Prost. It's that tiny, it's a tiny little one car garage. It's 10 by 13 footprint.
Okay.
Very small, 10 foot ceiling. Just a teeny gallery. So we're going to put on puppet shows for the month of August, the whole month of August in there. And that's the idea, is what happens when you do put performers and small shows in a venue where people can see it in full. Like, you can just stand around and it's intimate and private, and maybe they're weird, and they're not all ages. Not all of them are all ages. So, if we can only fit 10 people at a time, we're going to black out the whole gallery. And so it'll be summer. So, there's lots of sun happening outside, and all of a sudden you go into a dark theater and you see a 15-minute puppet show. They're about 15 to 20 minutes each, and there's 7 different performers and 20 shows in total over the course of 3 weekends. So I'd never done anything larger in terms of that many shows, but I'm hoping to, it's a lower ticket price, and the tickets are only $5 each, and it's one big experiment, basically. I don't know what it's going to be like. And I don't know if it's going to be a lot of pre-sale tickets. I don't know if people are going to show up. I'm totally willing to just like sort of go down Mississippi and try and scoop tourists, like, do you want to see a puppet show today? Because if I were that tourist, I'd be like, yeah, totally. I'm there.
So it's a tiny puppet show. So when you kind of sent out the call for artists, did you have a maximum size, like no bigger than 6 inches?
No. So that's funny. I think what I did when I sent out the call is I wanted to find people that were doing toy theater.
Okay.
But I also knew that toy theater wasn't really a thing that people knew what that was here.
Right.
So it's why the name of the festival is the Tiny Puppet Theater Festival. It's just a little more, I think, universal in a way. But I sent out I cast a pretty wide net, because I wasn't sure who would be around. And you never know. I actually had people applying from Berlin and Canada.
Wow.
Yeah, Southern California, East Coast, West Coast. Like, I had people from all over. But unfortunately, the funds that I had didn't stretch far enough to bring people in from Berlin. I wish.
Yeah, that'd be
maybe
great.
Next year. maybe next year. But yeah, so it basically ended up being just Seattle and Portland puppeteers when it came down to it.
Okay.
My friend Scott Foster owns Good Gallery, and he and I curated the shows and picked out the ones that we thought would fit best in the space. Because we didn't say, oh, your show, we didn't want to constrain it. Your show has to fit into 10 by 10 inches or anything like
right.
that. We just wanted to know what was out there. So we cast a wider net without too many restrictions and then picked, and some people submitted several shows, and a lot of them were just too large for the space, or they were too far away or things like that. So that's really the way it was curated, was by on merit for sure, like the shows that were the most developed, but also people that were close got a preference this time.
Right. Did any of the type of puppetry or techniques surprise you? What could be done on such a small scale?
You know, not everybody submitted or was able, like, had a fully formulated show, but some people had some really cool ideas that I would love to see. I was really looking for shows that were already built and done. And from the ones that I saw, there was some... Do you know what a cranky is? Have you ever heard
no.
of a cranky? Another type of puppetry right here. So crankies are like, they're like scrolls. They're
okay.
scroll shows, and they sit up in a box, like in a frame, and you roll one side of it and the paper moves, and you can do puppets
oh.
in front of it. Or the paper tells a part of the story and it changes the background scenery
oh, interesting.
As it rolls.
Okay.
So that's a cranky. And there's actually a cranky festival that happens in Seattle every year. There's also a puppet slam up there. Those guys are awesome. They do the Fussy Cloud Puppet Slam. That happens several times a year as well. And we oftentimes cross-pollinate performers for
oh,
shows.
Okay.
But there's a cranky festival. So some people submitted some cranky shows that were really great. Unfortunately, none of them are going to be in the festival this year. But it sort of got me thinking about that type of puppet theater, too. It's really fun. Oh, that's not true. Anna Cosper is doing a show, and I believe that she has a cranky background in hers.
So is that... Would that be two puppeteers, one person to do the scroll and then another person to do the puppets?
Sometimes it's two. A lot of times I've seen it done with just one person. They'll do the crank and I think there's a little bit more of a performance aspect to it too, is it's usually the performer speaking to the audience and narrating as they're cranking, and then, you know, they usually narrate as they're doing their little tiny shows, and they dip the puppets down from the top and ride them around. And
okay.
Yeah. I don't know. There's so many ways that I do get surprised by what people do. One time I saw a show in New York that the guy mounted a camera on a crank, and as you cranked it, the camera itself moved very slowly across a guitar case,
mm-hmm.
and that was projected up onto a screen.
Okay.
And then he would like fly birds through the view of the camera. So you could kind of see what he was doing as a performer on the stage, but really you were watching the screen, because it was all very carefully put together for you to watch up on the screen.
Neat.
But it was still live, you know, it still had that live performance aspect of like things could go wrong, like his camera could get stuck or hit a bump, or
right.
He could drop one of the bird puppets or something, you know. So
yeah.
And he had a microphone and he was just sort of looking at what he was doing up on the monitor without really even looking at his hands, because that's another thing with Muppet style Muppets, is that if you're doing Muppet style for TV, that's a whole different animal, where you have your hand up in the air and then your eyes are down looking at
oh,
a monitor,
right.
because you don't really know, like, it hurts your brain. It's crazy. And it's like you move the puppet this way and the screen moves the other way.
Oh, right.
It's like, it's called reverse. Is it reverse sweep monitor? No, reverse sweep is when you can get it right. Anyway, you look at the monitor and the puppet goes the opposite direction that you think it's supposed to go, and it makes your brain hurt real bad.
You know, I'm slightly dyslexic, and that would make my brain hurt.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love how there's is like almost a seemingly endless type of puppetry.
Yeah. I could just make some salt and pepper shakers move, and that's a puppet show. You don't even need googly eyes.
Great. So you're doing puppet slams, tiny puppet shows, and then next up is you're going to... tour Asia.
Yeah, I have been wanting to study puppetry in Asia for a long time, and so I'm going on a sort of self-guided Asian puppetry tour in October. So I just booked a flight basically, and I will go. I'm gonna try and connect with puppeteers through UNIMA, which is a national organization that tells it, they put out publications. They try and connect people. They curate festivals, I think, too. I'm just a new member here, so I'm actually still figuring out what they do. But I know that they're a huge puppetry resource around the world, and they give out grants, and I think they have their own festivals and things like that. So I'm going to try and connect with them to see if there's anybody doing anything that I need to know about.
Yeah.
They've been known to set puppeteers up with other puppeteers to stay, you know, and see what they're up to. Really what I'm most interested in, I want to study the traditional stuff, anything traditional happening in Thailand and Vietnam and Bali. I want to see all of that generations passed down through generations kind of puppet families. I'm curious about that.
Okay.
But I'm also curious about what the younger generations are doing to turn that on its end.
Yeah.
I want to know what new puppetry looks like there. You know, America doesn't really have one specific type of archetypal puppetry that we've always done.
Okay.
And they do. They do. And there's, and it'll be like Indonesian shadow shows are, you know, leather, their hides, like animal hides that have been cut out and punched leather. And they have these archetypal characters, much like Commedia dell'arte, if you know anything about Italian Lazzis and things like that. There's stock characters and similar storylines that get told over and over again. Okay. And they, some of them, I'm told, last for days.
Wow.
And people go, it's a very community-based thing, and you eat and you sleep and you hang out there and you watch, and then not a lot happens, and then it's gamelan music, or this is all, it varies from different country. There's water puppetry in Vietnam. There's, you know, Bali has mask work stuff too that's really incredible. So
what is water puppetry?
So from what I understand and what I've seen on YouTube, they would make puppets in Vietnam in the rice paddy fields.
Okay.
So they would, and these puppets are diving, like literally diving in and out of the water, and you don't see the puppeteers. They're behind a screen, like 6 to 8 feet behind these puppets. They look incredibly complicated. So complicated that I don't even understand. When I'm watching it, I don't get it.
I'm so gonna go on YouTube and search this.
Yeah, just Google Vietnamese water puppetry and you'll see it. It's pretty, a lot of the stuff that will pop up feels very like, this is a fun dragon just jumping in and out of the water. And it does feel sort of like, this is for the tourists, but at the same time, I'm just boggled. My mind is boggled. I want to see it. Like, I want to see what that is, because I don't understand it.
Like, what type of material would you even use? Because obviously not paper.
No. That would not be good. So I don't know. They've developed it. I think there's a lot of bamboo involved. But
I could see that.
For the different mechs and stuff like that, that they need to operate from behind this screen.
Huh.
But I feel like I could Google and YouTube all day from my home, but I don't really know what it's like. And that's sort of the point of going out there. I'm going to be there for a total of 6 weeks and traveling between Thailand, Vietnam, and Indonesia.
I could see that heavily influencing your work when you get back.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'll be changed.
Yeah. So if people want to find out what kind of puppet events you're doing, where would they find Beady Little Eyes?
So beadylittleeyes.com is our website. It's a blog. You can sign up for the mailing list at the bottom. There's a little box you can throw your email into. And then we have a Facebook page. Obviously, it's just Beady Little Eyes Puppet Slams.
Okay.
And those are the two main places. I try and, of course, get listings in local press, you know, the Mercury, Willamette Week, and all that stuff. And they've always been very good to me in terms of listing the events. So there's always, hopefully there's a shout out in one of those every time we do a show.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being on Bread and Roses.
Thank you.
Touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Marching, so many women dead. We cry through our city, their ancient call for bread. Our stomachs are empty, but our hearts are hungry too.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the White Bear Polar Tundra album release show on Saturday, September 6th at 9 p.m. Opening bands include The Great Hiatum and Snow Roller. White Bear Polar Tundra stands for environmental progress with a conscientious DIY ethic, and their debut album, Strikes Back, is their effort to create progressive, head-turning music. This show is playing at Alhambra Theater, located at 4811 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information about this KBOO co-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is preparing for our legendary book and record sale happening on Sunday, September 14th at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. We're accepting donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, VHS, and cassette tapes, and all donations are tax deductible. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit your community radio station, KBOO. So bring those donations down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. For more information, please contact Jesse, 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer at kboo.org. That's the annual book and record sale on Sunday, September 14th.
It is 7:01 and you are listening to your only community radio station, KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.